Maybe it was your sixth grade teacher, or your know-it-all neighbor, or maybe on a bad day, one of your parents. But for me, it was my band instructor. He was scary, especially when we were getting close to competitions. If you were not listening closely to his every instruction, if you dared to come into his class unprepared, he would start going down the line and making us play the part in question. And if you did not have it, he would let loose. Now, it wasn't just me who was scared of him. My brother recently told me he still has anxiety dreams to this day with Mr. Taylor in them, not his name to protect the innocent. Nobody likes to be humiliated like that, to be the subject of a peevish lecture listing all your failures and mistakes. And I have to confess that our texts for today on first reading sound a little bit like that. Wisdom, personified in the book of Proverbs, is out on the street corner and she is going off. And then there's this incredible piece from James, a blistering word of caution about the trouble we can get into when we run our mouths. Any passage that has six comments about fire in two sentences is not playing, right? And then Jesus puts Peter in his place, and all I'll say about that is I cannot imagine that Peter looks back on this particular moment with a lot of pride. But it does beg the question, is that how we should hear these texts today? Is that how we should think about wisdom as the stern, demanding, critical voice of whoever it was in your past that got off on putting you in your place? It's tempting to think of wisdom that way if you're thinking about offering words of wisdom about other people. Remember Gordon's playful opening to his sermon last week where he talked about how all these folk were going to join him in talking about the people on the lectern side? Kind of wondered if everybody was going to be over here today. There's a way in which, and he talked about this last week, you get a twisted sense of pride when you can stand up and look out and assess and correct everyone in your view. It is easy to hear these texts in that vein. When we live in a world where that is the game, then posturing and pretending and covering your tracks is all a part of it. When it's all about image, about how people see you, how you measure up against them, then if you do find yourself making a mistake, you often try to make sure that nobody knows about it. I can still remember very clearly when a therapist tried to help me understand this game, as I've just named it. I was somewhere in my middle 20s and complaining about some power struggle I was in with someone. I honestly don't recall if it was professional or personal, but I'll never forget when she said to me a line I'm sure you've heard before, when she said, "Jill, do you want to be right or do you want to be happy?" The compulsion to be right all the time, to be seen as good or competent or strong, can fill in the word with whichever thing gives the most juice to this dynamic for you. But whatever that compulsion is, it is the enemy of wisdom. As I said to the children, wisdom is about more than just knowing things. It's about being able to take what you know and put it into practice. And what serves wisdom so much more than just raw intellect is the capacity to learn. As James acknowledges, all of us make many mistakes. Did you catch that? Many mistakes. The question is, will we acknowledge them? Not for the sake of self-flagellation, but for the sake of learning. Get a very different picture when you go back to the book of Proverbs and hear it through the lens of love resisted. Because at first, of course, it is cold and harsh in verse 26 when wisdom promises to laugh when calamity comes or when panic strikes. But it takes a very different tone when you think of it as the exasperated voice of someone who has been trying in vain to get through to someone she loves. Someone who will not listen and does not learn, who keeps making the same mistakes and is running headlong toward destruction and refuses to receive any correction or guidance. I hear in this piece of poetry what we have come to call the pathos of God, the grief that expresses itself like rage when love is resisted. And as you walk through this piece from Proverbs, you can hear the longing of God for all of us to receive the offering of wisdom's thought and counsel, of her correction and instruction. She has so much to give to us, and we have so much to learn, but only if we can find the right posture and position that makes it possible. And this story from Mark, I think, reveals both to us. Peter uncovers the posture and position as he steps in it here with Jesus. It's always fun to learn through somebody else's mistakes, right, rather than our own. So we'll do that today through Peter. And I want to observe something before we look more closely at the text. This is not the first or the last moment when Peter will play the fool before Jesus. But eventually, Peter gets to this place of strength and clarity, where his passion will be used for the purposes of God so beautifully. Just look at him on the day of Pentecost. But he only gets there because of moments like this one. Or maybe to say it more precisely, because of what he learns and integrates after moments like this one. If he was more concerned with his image, so that he was kind of hanging back with all the other disciples, not wanting to make any mistakes or risk anything, then he would not get into these moments like he does with Jesus here. And these are crucible moments where his mistakes pull this profound and clear teaching from Jesus straight into his heart in a way that he will never forget. So first, the posture. Now, this passage in Mark comes right on the heels of a healing story. I don't know if you remember this one. It's when the blind man comes to Jesus and he puts his saliva on the man's eyes and asks, "Can you see?" And the man looks out and yes, he can see, but he can see light and objects moving, but cannot see clearly what it is. And so Jesus brings a second touch and then asks him again. And the man looked intently, it said, and his sight is restored and he saw everything clearly. Now, as Lamar Williamson points out in a commentary on this text, these two stories, the healing and the passages we read today, they sit at the very center of Mark's gospel. It's a critical turning point that reveals the posture of discipleship that we all need to take. Up until this moment, the disciples had been watching Jesus' ministry of power out in Galilee, where he was healing and casting out demons and giving this profound teaching, and the crowds were gathering around, and his popularity was rising. And so at this moment, Jesus puts a question. It's not unlike the one to the blind man when he said, "Can you see?" And he asks, "Who do people say that I am?" And then more pointedly, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter offers the right words. He says, "You are the Messiah." But does he yet have clear vision for what that all means? In verse 31, Jesus is pivoting away from that ministry of power in Galilee. And he is turning toward Jerusalem and the suffering that is going to come. And he warns them that all of his prestige and popularity that they had come to admire was going to fall away as he stays very true to offend the powerful and the elite. It is not going to always be glory and accolades and honor. There is going to be suffering and betrayal and rejection. He, in fact, is going to be killed. But that is not going to stop the power of God's realm. Peter doesn't realize this. Like the blind man, he's seeing, but he's not fully understanding. And because he doesn't realize what it is that he does not know, he steps into this posture of authority with Jesus and rebukes him as if he were the patron and Jesus were the disciple. Because that word rebuke in the gospel is always used to describe Jesus' power to rebuke the winds, to rebuke the demons. It is not the posture of a disciple or a student. So Jesus puts him in his place. But not to demean him or humiliate him, but so that he can begin to continue on that trajectory of learning and wisdom. When Jesus tells Peter to get behind him, he is showing him the position where we need to be if we want to learn from Jesus and take in the wisdom he has to give to us. Granted, he does so with very colorful language, right? Calling him the adversary, Satan. But that position behind Jesus, it's the very same word he will use in the next verse when he talks about us taking up our cross and following after him. It's the same Greek word that means after. At the end of the day, Jesus isn't really putting Peter in his place the way we do it, to put people down. He is helping him to find the right posture, the right position. It's not a below and above. It's a with. It's relational. That's the position. And the posture is an open heart. It's about the joy of being wrong when those mistakes lead us to change course and to learn. Around the time that I first started sharing some of my experience these last months of struggling to find that right path to be responsive and wise in the work of justice and faith, one of my elders shared with me a piece that I read every day for a while. They're actually your elders too, but I like to call them my elders. It makes me feel connected, and I feel the support more strongly. And I want to share with you, as I close, the words that she shared with me that come from Thomas Merton in his letter to a young activist. Because in it, he describes so beautifully the wisdom that Jesus is offering to his disciples, the kind of wisdom that we all need to embody if we are to be of use in God's realm. Merton writes these words: "Do not depend on the hope of results. When you are doing the sort of work that you have taken on, essentially an apostolic work, you may have to face the fact that your work will be apparently useless and even achieve no result at all, if not perhaps opposite to the result you want. And you start more and more to concentrate not on the results, but on the value, the rightness, the truth of the work itself. And there, too, a great deal has to be gone through as gradually you struggle less and less for an idea and more for specific people. The range tends to narrow down, but it gets much more real. In the end, it is the reality of personal relationship that saves everything. If we want to be followers of Jesus, may it be so for us. And in the words of the psalmist, let the words of my mouth and the meditation of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen."